Good morning. The Senate Education Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Wednesday, March 23rd, 2022 at 9:04 a.m. We're meeting in State Cap Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Hughes, Senator Stevens, Senator Begich, and myself as Chair, Senator Holland. Senator Machicki will be possibly joining us shortly. Thank you to Mary Gwen, our Recording Secretary, and Kelsey, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Today, we will continue to work on Senate Bill 225 relating to teacher apprenticeship programs. I will now bring 225 back before the committee. This is the sixth hearing on Senate Bill 225. We've had several questions come up over the last few weeks, and today we have a few experts available to answer those questions. All right, so good morning to everyone on Teams and the phone, and welcome to Senate Education. At this time, we will start with Stacy Barnes from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And let's see, there's Ms. Barnes. And please state your name, your affiliation, and your location for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Stacey Barnes. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Good morning, Ms. Barnes. So I was wondering if you could speak a little about the current teacher housing program offered by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much for inviting AHFC to present in front of your committee today. The Teacher, Health Professional, and Public Safety Housing Program is one that the corporation continues to be very excited about. It was founded in 2004 when our former CEO, Dan Fauske, had personal experience in Barrow, recognizing that teachers had a very difficult time in rural communities finding safe, quality, and secure housing. And because of his business acumen, and the recognition of the need that existed across the state, this program was born. Initially, it started out as a program for teachers, and I see that you do have the map there in the room in front of you. That map represents the 500 units that have been developed since 2004 under this program. So the program itself is designed not only to develop new construction, but to rehab units that are in communities. And as these projects are developed, communities themselves identify the need and they work on a project plan. They will work with local health professionals oftentimes, as well as public safety officers in their communities. And the developments as they're constructed need to meet AHFC's minimum energy efficiency standards, which is a 5-star rating. For these projects, funding comes from a variety of sources. It's not uncommon for local communities to contribute land to the project. Financing may come in the form of traditional loans. Other grants may be provided. The Rasmussen Foundation and Denali Commission both have been instrumental partners in this program. And AHFC is able to provide the gap financing in order to make the projects happen across the state. And as you might imagine, because these homes are built in communities where the population is 6,500 or fewer on the road system or 600 or fewer off the road system, that sometimes some additional financial expertise is necessary. Reagan Mattingly is joining me from our planning department today and can answer any specific questions that you might have. But for these communities, Reagan and his team also provide counseling and support to individual communities so that they can be successful in their quest to build community housing for these professionals. So the process for AHFC and the timeline is, of course, that we come to you in the legislature and request funds through the capital budget process. Most often, the source of funds is AHFC's dividend, and those funds go to contribute to the projects. After the capital budget is signed, AHFC then goes through a competitive public process where we invite applicants to apply for the program, and we make the funding awards and announcements generally in October, allowing for construction to start as early as the next spring or next summer. I'm also pleased to report this year, Mr. Chairman, that through the omnibus package that was passed by Congress and signed into law, there was a $2 million earmark provided by Senator Murkowski that adds $2 million to the program this year. So we are asking the legislature for additional funds so that we can receive those monies and put them toward this program. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions, as is Reagan Mattingly, again, the director of our planning, member of our planning department.
Thank you, Ms. Barnes. Senator Stevens, did you have a question?
Yes, I just wonder, Ms. Barnes, can you tell us how are these properties disposed of? That's probably the wrong word, but the ownership goes to individual teachers, to the cities, to the boroughs, to the school districts. Is there any consistency there, or is it just all of those?
Through the chair, I would like to ask Reagan Mattingly to discuss that further, but in essence, Senator Stevens, it is the project owner who comes to us with the idea who owns that project, and so AHSC's contribution is strictly through the grant.
Yeah, and so the organization that applies for the grant is the one that manages the property, and typically will rent the property out to the professional that they're focused on. And there are deed restrictions involved with the program, and so they have to provide housing for that professional for up to 10 years is the minimum. And then the property is given to the grantee, and then they can do whatever they want with it after that 10-year period.
Mr. Mattingly, if you'd state your name, your affiliation, your location for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Reagan Mattingly, and I am a planner in the planning department at AHFC.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair. So, for the most part, these go to organizations like I assume school boards and maybe boroughs or cities, but not you don't finance for individual teachers. Would that be true? Yeah. Okay. Thank you,
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions. You mentioned that there's $2 million in the budget that came from the federal bipartisan infrastructure bill. What's the additional match amount that you need for that?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, there is no additional match requirement for that program. But what is currently in the budget is $1.75 million of AHFC's dividend and an additional $500,000 in SDPR. That is included in the governor's budget, capital budget right now.
In addition, in addition to the $2 million, so the total would be close to $4.2 million, is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, yes, that's correct. The additional $2 million is through the omnibus appropriations, federal funds, and it is the first time since this program started in 2004 that we've seen any contribution of federal dollars in the program.
May I continue for a couple of quick follow-ups on that? I just want to nail down the amounts.
I'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I get that right, the key here, you have a receipt authority for the $2 million, I assume, from the federal government. And then the second question would be, what is the actual need that comes into AHFC? And so what is the – you know, this is $4.2 million. You clearly are sounding like you can not just absorb it but use it. But so what is the requested need annually that comes in for this program?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, we are requesting a receipt authority of the $2 million. So we don't have that yet. But Mr. Mattingly can speak to the recent need of the program and going back a number of years for you.
Yeah, through the chair, Mr. Begich, we are typically receiving approximately 30 registrations for the program from different organizations across the state. This last application cycle, we received 10 full applications, and the total amount of units for all 10 applicants was 55 units. And so we were able to fund 4 of those 10 applications, and the total units funded was 13 of the total 55 of all the applicants. So, you know, we're seeing more need and demand for the program than we're able to provide at this point in time.
Mr. Chairman, I was just asking that question because Senator Hughes has brought up in the past, and we've discussed here, this need for teacher housing, but we have to identify the amount annually that would be necessary. And it sounds like we're filling about a fifth, from what they just said, about a fifth of the need that's requested annually.
All right. Thank you, Senator Begich. I neglected to welcome Senator Machicki to the committee when he joined us. Senator Machicki, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. I wasn't here at the beginning. I'm sorry. I saw the 500 units since 2004. But is there a kind of ultimate comprehensive plan on required housing for, and I wasn't here to find out if you're also involved with public safety housing. But if we're just talking about teacher housing, do you have a long-term plan of what meets the need in rural Alaska for teachers specifically? I assume you're just building as you're funded, but what, in a perfect world, what does the number of units look like?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, thank you very much for asking that question. As we look at this program, it is important for us to look back over time at the number of applications that come in for funding, and you're right that this program doesn't just address teacher housing in communities, it also addresses public safety as well as health professionals. And so an ideal project may be a fourplex that includes two units for teachers, one for a public safety officer, and one for a health professional in the community. Because the grants themselves are competitively awarded, I don't know that we could, and perhaps Mr. Mattingly can provide more information on this, that we could project a need across the state, but we could certainly provide the committee with background about the number of projects that have been requested over the last decade and have not been funded. It has not been uncommon where one grantee may come in a particular year, not be successful in receiving an award, but come back again the following year after having refined their application a bit more.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I would love to see a document like that, if possible, just for kind of a greater understanding of the need, if possible.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Machicki. Mr. Mattingly, do you have anything to offer?
No, I think Stacy really covered it for the most part. But, you know, a lot of the data we have is anecdotal, a lot of really just, you know, qualitative data. We haven't really done a large quantitative study on specifically teachers in, you know, the last few years. We did do recently a study with the Department of Public Safety and did look at public safety and specifically troopers in rural Alaska and their housing needs. And, you know, that included a survey and a study. So, you know, we have focused at different times on you know, coming up with more data and information regarding the different professional groups. And the one we've done most recently is Department of Public Safety Troopers.
All right. Senator Hughes.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. Good to see you, Reagan. Reagan and I used to work together before my life in the legislature. I actually, my original question that I jotted down was answered by, based on the questions from these two gentlemen, but it triggered another one, and you mentioned you have done a look at the need for the troopers. Is it within the purview of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation actually to do some kind of a study and come back to the legislature to, for the health professionals, teachers, and troopers, so we kind of know what the unmet expected need is over, let's say, the next 5 years, the next 10 years?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the process that evolved for the study that Reagan mentioned with public safety was done at the request of the Department of Public Safety itself and with the governor's office. And so we certainly can make that report available to the committee, and we'd be happy to discuss with the education about a study that would be worthwhile for them as well.
Thank you.
Senator Begich.
Thank you. I just want to, Mr. Chairman, I want to nail this down. So I just gathered that there are applications that don't qualify. So my question maybe is a little bit different. It's It's of the applications that qualified. Do you have enough resources presently to fund them? Or what I'm getting at here is there a funding issue that's keeping, or is it a matter keeping structures from being built or rehabbed? Or is it an issue of poor grant writing? Because if indeed you have the resources now, we should know that. And if you don't have the resources now, we should know that. So is it a question of the grants just aren't qualifying, but you have the resources? Or is it that even qualified applications aren't being funded?
Thank you for that question through the chair. Senator Begich, the maximum grant amount that goes toward any project is $500,000. And that allows us to be able to contribute to funding in more than one community. And so depending on the amount of dollars that come in, represents the number of grants that we can make each year. Certainly, Mr. Mattingly can speak to you about any deficiencies with applications that have come in the recent past. But again, we do provide counseling for those agencies to try to get them to a point at a future year where we will be able to fund their project. As Mr. Mattingly said, and I'm just forgive me, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking through our FY22 grant announcements, and I think that Mr. Mattingly had shared with you that there were 10 projects that came to AHFC. Four of those were funded. Mr. Mattingly, can you provide additional detail about those projects and answer Mr. Begich's question through the chair?
Through the chair, Mr. Begich, we received, so it was a total of 55 units of the 10 applicants, and I think all but one of the applicants was an application that we could fund. And so I think that 9 out of the 10 met the threshold requirements to be able to participate in the program. So it ended up being a decision to prioritize which projects, met the criteria. We have a scoring criteria and a threshold requirement. So once an applicant meets the threshold, the minimum threshold, then we score the applications and rank them based on our scoring criteria. And so we basically just picked the ones that scored the highest and had the highest needs in their community. And so, I think with more funding, we certainly would have provided additional projects with funding. But at this point, we prioritize based on our scoring criteria to rank each applicant.
Appreciate the answer. That answers my question.
All right. Thank you, Senator Begich. Are there any other questions from the committee? Oh, Senator Stevens.
I think it's an interesting discussion. I really appreciate what AHFC has done. I appreciate Dan Fowsky's leadership on this. We have tremendous needs. So we've heard lots of stories lately of teachers have to share housing with people they don't know. Substandard housing in many communities. I don't know how what we're sort of getting at, I think all of us, is that there needs to be some long-term planning. I don't know if it's you, I don't know if it's the Department of Education, but somehow we need to plan this out and begin to make a bigger dent. You've done a tremendous job, no question about it, with 500 units, but there's still this enormous need and substandard housing out there for teachers. As you said, we need to include police as well as the health folks. So I don't know who would take charge of doing a sort of overall study for us of what the needs are and how we move ahead to fund those.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, certainly AHFC would be happy to work with the Department of Education on a project like you are proposing. And you're absolutely right about the kinds of stories that you hear. Both Dan Fowsky and our current CEO, Brian Butcher, speak very articulately about various needs that they have heard in communities, challenges where a teacher may take a job in a rural community, fly in, and find out at the end of her first day or his first day that their bedroom is also their classroom, and they simply have to put a bed down and stay there, and that teacher doesn't stay in the community very long. And, of course, that's a detriment to the entire community and to the children in that classroom. And so it really is something that we take very seriously here when we think about the 500 units that have been built. The number of children whose lives have been improved as a result of having stability with teachers in their communities for multiple years. And the same is true with the public safety and health professionals in those communities. The assets and the expertise, the relationships that are built with families is critically important, and we see it firsthand.
Well, so thank you. I really appreciate what you've done. It's tremendous. But there's a bigger picture out there, and I don't know who would take charge of that, maybe the administration or something, but we'll think about that and see is there a way that we can help move it forward so we keep clicking off these. I mean, I would think 500 units are wonderful, but 2,000 units are probably more reasonable. Thank you.
All right. And Ms. Barnes, I believe this question was asked. If you could just remind me, I might have been distracted writing a note or something. So of these 500 units, typically who winds up owning the units, the school or the community or the teacher? Could you remind me what the answer was to that question? I believe it had already been asked and answered.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For each project, it's going to be dependent on the individual that comes forward with the project. So in most cases, it is the local school district, although it may be a community itself. It might be a tribal entity. And Mr. Mattingly, would you like to add any detail or have any percentages, perhaps, that we can follow up with the committee on when we respond to them later with some of the other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that the program, you know, for the most part, goes to a school district or a community health center, a nonprofit organization, or a tribal government. And so that is probably about 95% of the time it'll go to one of those entities. And that's who owns the project and who is required to meet the deed requirements of housing the professionals that they agree on for 10 years.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for that answer. Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Machicki.
I'm sorry. We're getting into – mine's a little bit in the weeds, and it was just basically on the construction methods. Are we sending packages of raw materials to rural Alaska and constructing homes, or have we really peeled back the onion layers on modular construction at a lower cost for more units and that sort of – thing? Is that something you can answer, or — and we don't need to spend a lot of time on it — I'm just curious if we've really evaluated the most cost effective way to provide more housing.
And maybe a clarification on that: is it typically, do they just release the funds and leave it to the local to plan the construction? But Ms. Barnes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Machicki. So when Reagan was talking about the competitive process that occurs, AHFC is looking at the total cost of the development. And in doing so, we do have requirements for things like minimum energy efficiency standards on those homes. AHFC is not providing any materials and sending them out. It really is up to the local project sponsor to develop a project that is in the best interest of their community and what that looks like. Of course, we have an appreciation for the lower cost units, but also that meet minimum quality standards so that we can achieve that right balance in the communities.
All right.
Yeah, and just wanted to add, Mr. Chairman and Senator Machicki, I think, you know, we do score projects based on a lower total development cost. And so a project that has a more economically competitive kind of, you know, balance sheet will receive higher points and at the end of the day, a higher priority. So that's one of the scoring criteria is, you know, the cost of the project.
Thank you, Mr. Mattingly. With no other questions from the committee, thank you, Ms. Barnes. Thank you, Mr. Mattingly. And, next, we will move on to Steve Atwater from the Brief at Ease. Thank you. Senate Education is back on the record. Sorry, there's a kind of a lively discussion on actually identifying the level of need and how to identify the level of need and maybe how to tie it into this bill. Just to return to Ms. Barnes, if she's still available, and see if she pops back up. Ms. Barnes, are you still there? Ah, thank you so much. Yes. There was also Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Ms. Barnes, one of the questions we were kicking around that we don't understand is so someone applies for a project, they're approved, they build this project. It wasn't clear if there were loans or not. You talked about the earmarks, of course, would not be something that had to be paid back by the state. So what we're trying to understand is who collects the rent? Where does that money go? Is it covering financing for a project back to AHFC? Does it go to the school board or the school district? How does that work?
Or could it even go on to funding the next property development in the neighborhood? So are these grants, do they have to be paid back or do they go, where's the money go?
So AHFC's participation in these projects, Mr. Chairman, is that the teacher health professional and public safety housing program does provide up to $500,000 in the form of a grant to the project sponsor. It is the project sponsor who owns the project or the development and is responsible for acquiring any rents and paying any loans back that might go along with that particular property. So in most cases, it is the school district itself locally who owns those projects, and the teacher may be paying the school district the rent as the owner.
Senator Begich.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Stacy, to clarify, too, you did a public safety housing need study that had a cost to it. Would you mind sharing with us, you don't have to do it on the record now, but when you provide the copy of that study, sharing us with us the cost of that study so we have an idea of what a housing need study might cost.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Begich, through the chair, we would be happy to do that for you. For the study that we did for Department of Public Safety, though, it really was about interviewing existing troopers and trying to understand what their needs are for housing. As an example, one of the things that we learned is that many of the troopers in the communities have families, so they may need more bedrooms associated with their units than a young teacher who may be traveling to a rural community who's early on in their career. So that's kind of the kind of information that we learned through our study. And so the work that we did was done entirely through AHFC, and I'm not sure that there was a cost associated to it outside of the normal operations of our business, but I will confirm that for you.
Senator Machicki.
So if a school district a unit is built, school district owns it, they collect the rents, does this have the potential to be a progressive or rotating program where eventually when you set aside the maintenance of the facility, the net proceeds could go to the next project, or is it kind of closed end where that's the net profits go back to the district to offset other costs, or does it move forward to help provide additional housing in the future?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I think it's a very interesting question. Of course, what we see with housing is that there are operations and maintenance requirements that go along with the property. And so how those funds are used, I'm not sure that there would be enough added funds that money could be returned to AHFC and invested in future properties. But it is an interesting question that I'd be happy to check with our team about.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Barnes, for coming back. And Senator Hughes.
And this one, Mr. Chair, maybe for Reagan, if he's available, if Stacy doesn't know, but the grants of $500,000, typical projects, are they financing an equal or less amount or more amount than the $500,000 to complete the project, or does $500,000 sometimes cover it? for some of your awarded applicants. So I'm just wondering if that rent is, if rent is collected, is paying off in most projects, is paying off other loans associated with the project.
Sure. And through the chair, Senator Hughes, as I'm looking right now at our FY20 through FY22 awards, most of the housing that has been awarded or received a grant from HFC are duplexes or triplexes. However, there are some outliers. In FY20, Nome, as an example, built 18 units and received the $500,000 grant from HFC. So, Mr. Mattingly, could you perhaps add some more detail?
Yeah, absolutely. Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the program, every project is so completely different with this program. And so it really just depends. We do have the hard cap of $500,000 we can contribute. And so, depending on the project's budget, it could be a very, very small portion of the project, or we do require a minimum of a 15% match. So some projects will come in and they're only able to raise the minimum 15% match. The average match over the lifetime of the program is about 37.5%. So that's average across the board of what additional funding that the organization applying for the program provides. And so many of the projects are very much gap funded projects where, the project really would have a lot of trouble getting off the ground or even, being built if it wasn't for the gap funding we provide. But we do have an underwriting process that's based on the financials that an organization submits in their application. And so based on what they, the makeup of their rents that they're collecting, if they're charging rent to a teacher, and their costs, all the utilities, we're able to do an underwriting calculation to see if they can afford a loan portion of an award. And so that's how we decide if an organization can afford a loan, then typically we'll give them part of the award in a grant form and then part based on their underwriting calculation in a loan. And so they'll pay that loan back and that'll go into a future project. So it really all depends. Every project is so different. It depends on the kind of the financial makeup of the organization and how they're funding the construction of the project.
Thank you. That's helpful.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. With no other questions, Senator Stevens.
Not a question of these folks, but just for us, because I think we'll find that some districts don't even charge rent. That's a cost of doing business, getting someone to move out to a small village to live there, and they don't charge a rent, or maybe even a minimal rent. But in any event, the district has to pay the teacher in order to pay the rent. So we really need to hear from the department what kind of recommendations they may have.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. All right, Mr. Mattingly, Ms. Barnes, thank you for all those answers. And at this point, we're going to move on to Mr. Steve Atwater, and I see he's queued up, regarding the statewide mentorship program, slightly different topic. So, Mr. Atwater, if you'd start off with stating your name, your affiliation, and your location, and put yourself on the record.
Yes, good morning, Chair Holland. For the record, my name is Steve Atwater. I'm a contractor with the Alaska Statewide Mentor Project, and I'm calling from Anchorage today.
All right, thank you for joining us this morning. Welcome to Senate Education, and would you walk us through your slide presentation?
Yes, I'd also like to put on the record Glenda Findlay, who's online too. She's the director of the K-12 Outreach Office.
All right. Ms. Findlay, if you just state your name, your affiliation, and your location, put yourself on the record.
Absolutely. For the record, my name is Glenda Findlay. I am the director of the K-12 Outreach Office at UAF, and I'm housed in Fairbanks.
Thanks so much. And if Mr. Atwater, if you'd please proceed.
Yeah. Chair Holland, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for the invitation to testify on Senate Bill 225. Thank you also, Chair Holland, to Ed King for his communications with me. I think he deserves an award for fastest response time on an email. That guy's awesome, so thank you for that. I began work with the Mentor Project in October to help ASMP to be included in state-level policy. We see Senate Bill 225 as a good way to do this. I want to note that Ms. Finley has been with the ASMP and the K-12 Outreach Office for the past 10 years, and as such has a deep knowledge of the project's operations. I'll be using two acronyms during this presentation. ASMP stands for the Alaska Statewide Mentor Project, and ECT stands for Early Career Teacher. Next slide, please.
Next slide is that. Oh, we're looking actually at slide three right now. Do you want slide two?
Slide two, please.
There it is.
Okay. Thank you. So in this presentation, I'll provide an overview of ASMP, including a summary of how the project is funded. I'll then comment on Senate Bill 225 and suggest that the bill should also include language to support activity that will help to retain teachers. And finally, I'll offer a way for ASMP to be included as one of the bill's strategies to do this. Next slide, please.
Slide three.
This slide provides an overview of ASMP. I won't read through each bullet, but I did want to emphasize several key points. First of all, ASMP has been in existence since 2004, and during this time has been continually improved. When former Governor Murkowski and former Commissioner Sampson started ASMP, I was a superintendent in a small rural school district that had limited to no capacity to mentor its early career teachers. ASMP then was a previously unknown benefit for us. It's also important to note that the mentors are full-time release. They do not have other commitments. This is significant when compared to other in-district mentors who often have regular teaching duties in addition to mentoring a new hire. The third point I want to make is the mentoring model developed by the new teacher center that ASMP follows is research-based. ASMP continuously modifies it to meet the unique needs of the Alaska context. As you know, adjusting to and then incorporating the local context into instruction can be difficult for teachers who are new to our state. The mentors, with the help of the mentors help the teachers a great deal with this. This is an important point in terms of longevity and retention. Next slide, please.
Slide four.
Slide four. The mentors are all experienced master teachers, but are not eligible to mentor until they have completed extensive training in how to mentor. I note in the slide that having a lot of teaching experience does not automatically equate to being a good mentor. It takes training. I also want to stress that the selection process for the mentors is rigorous. We are going through that process right now, and just because you have experience doesn't mean you make it through the door. Our mentors support the mentees virtually and in person, and I'm pleased to share that the mentors are again traveling to schools now that the COVID has waned a bit. And I included a quote on this slide just to illustrate some of the support that the ECTs feel when they receive mentoring. Slide five, please.
A quick question. So they're full-time release mentors. What's the ratio of mentors to mentees? Is it 1-to-1 or 1-to-5? Or?
No, and Glenda can help me with this. I believe it's 1-to-8 or so, Glenda?
1-to-15.
115, excuse me.
Thanks so much. Senator Hughes.
And how many mentors are we employing in a typical school year?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Hughes, the next slide I'm going to get to will detail those numbers.
All right, please proceed.
Yes, slide five. Here are some numbers to allow you to gain a sense of the scale of ASMP in Alaska. Note that the state discontinued its fiscal support for ASMP in 2015, and you can see the total numbers of ECTs served and mentors begin to decrease after this. The table on the right shows you the percentage of Alaska's ECTs that received ASMP support. Obviously, it would be good to increase this percentage. And so while the product does excellent work, it unfortunately, due to fiscal constraints, only serves a small portion of the state's early career teachers. So that number has come down, as you can see, since 2015, when the state, due to fiscal constraints, stopped funding. I'll start providing some funding for ASMP. Slide six. This slide summarizes how ASMP is funded. I want to note that former UA President Johnson included UA funds for ASMP, and now UA President Pitney is doing the same. While ASMP is not a university function per se, the two presidents recognize its importance to UA, K-12, and Alaska, so both deserve thanks for their support during the tight fiscal times. The recent federal grant that's listed underneath on the third bullet will begin to support additional mentors beginning in August. This grant will focus on supporting ECTs in high-need rural remote schools and will, at its height, increase the served ECT percentage above 40%. And that expectation assumes that the number of ECTs is static, around 700 a year. Slide 7, please.
Slide 7's up.
With regard to whether ASMP makes a difference, we have research that found there is a positive correlation between ASMP mentoring and student outcomes, as well as teacher retention. The first two bullets of this slide summarize this. Each year, ASMP surveys its various stakeholders, including the ECTs. The responses on the survey are positive, and ECTs regularly state that ASMP played a big role in helping them have a successful first 2 years of teaching. This, as you know, is critical to retention. More than a third of teachers leave during the first 5 years of being in the profession. Slide 8.
Slide 8.
So next, I want to move to SB 225, and thank you for introducing this bill. As you know, districts are having a difficult time hiring enough teachers. I've been involved with most of the conversations that are part of the bill, so it was good to see them being brought forward in this way. But as you know, the effect of the proposed changes in the bill will not be realized for a while. It is for this reason that I encourage you to add a section to the bill that supports teacher retention. It is critical that the state work to slow the churn of its teachers. I know that UA is working hard to recruit more students to its teacher preparation programs, and districts are more and more adept at recruiting teachers from out of state or now even from overseas. In spite of these efforts, there is a teaching shortage in Alaska that today, and there will be one in August when schools open after the summer break. It makes sense then to support teacher retention. We believe that ASMP is an excellent strategy that should be included in Senate Bill 225 to help with teacher retention. And as a side note, we also know from the retirement board that about 300 Tier 2 teachers are retiring each year. And so if you project forward and begin to see what's on the horizon, you can see that this issue is going to be a constant challenge. Next slide, please. Slide number 9.
Slide 9.
So when you look at retention strategies, you can broadly place them into two categories: those that are extrinsic motivators to help teachers stay in the profession, and those that are intrinsic motivators. Last week, you heard examples of extrinsic motivators for teacher retention. The longevity bonus offered by Bering Strait School District is an example of this. These extrinsic strategies are good, but in my opinion, they're not enough. I'm convinced that while the extrinsic motivators are important, a teacher must ultimately feel successful, must feel that their teaching is making a difference to be intrinsically motivated to continue in the profession. It is thus important when considering retention that attention is given to strategies that directly support the teacher's instruction and ultimately, of course, student learning. This support also helps the teacher foster relationships with students and the community that are so critical. When the intrinsic motivation to teach is high, some of the extrinsic variables that drive teachers from the profession may become less significant. That's an important point. Next slide, please. Slide 10.
Slide 10.
And so here's just a proposal that Glenda and I put together, and it's, like I said, it's just a proposal, but we feel that increasing the number of ASMP mentors supporting our state's ECT is an intrinsic strategy for improving student retention. I don't know what percent of turnover makes sense in terms of how you would do this. We listed 15% here as a starting point. But you know and I know that our remote districts often have turnover rates that are 20 to 30%. So offering ASMP mentors to support these districts' new hires will help lower this number. As mentioned, ASMP has a long history and a strong operations unit at the K-12 Outreach Office. The K-12 Outreach Office has the capacity to expand and the underlying foundation of the University of Alaska Fairbanks to support it. One other note of interest is that ASMP at times helps with the recruiting of teachers. When a teacher is interviewing for a job, he or she may ask, will I have a mentor? Well, if you're coming from Ohio and you know you have a mentor and you're going to Shishmaref, then that might be a way to entice that teacher to go there. And so I think that that's another advantage of having mentors out in the field to support our early career teachers. Each year, ASMP takes a hard look at itself through analyzing feedback from its stakeholders and through careful accounting of its activity. The project has developed an online portal to help track its activity to facilitate this analysis. I mention this because offering an annual report to you or to DEED on the use of state funds for this purpose would not be a heavy lift for the office. Next slide, please. Slide 11.
A quick question from Senator Machicki.
Hello, Steve. The ICER study said that the state average is 21%, and you have a cutoff here of 15. I know it's just a suggestion, but why 15%? I'm trying to visualize what communities are above or below 15%.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, thank you for the question. A broad brush look at things, like on the Kenai, the turnover rate hovers around 10%. Anchorage, you'd find something similar. Matsu, something similar. So the more remote you get, typically the higher the turnover rate. So 15 is just a ballpark number that I threw out as a way to get the conversation going. I think that if you look at the detailed report from Education Northwest that looked at teacher retention, I think you might have been presented to you last year. You'll see that those schools that are remote often experience the 20 to 30%, but 15% was just a number to start the conversation.
Thank you, Dr. Atwater.
With no other questions, please proceed.
Yeah, so slide 11 is our final slide. So in closing, thank you for the opportunity to present to you this morning, and thank you for bringing forward Senate Bill 225. I know you all recognize that this is critical. The state really needs to engage at this level. We encourage you to consider adding a new section to the bill that will support school district retention efforts, and in particular, include ASMP as a way to help with this. We think that we can play a good role with that retention. The slide includes the ASMP website URL and also Glenda and my contact information. Please don't hesitate to let us know if we can offer any additional information. And then the final slide of the packet, which I don't need to show, just includes some references that are included so that you have some reference documents or citations that you can use. With that, I'm happy to speak with you or answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Atwater. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Glenda and Dr. Atwater, for being here. I just want to make sure I heard correctly. I believe you said that one-third of teachers leave the profession in their first 5 years. And did I get that correctly? And also, how does that compare with other professions? That seems like a big group exiting.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that is a national figure. It is not Alaska's figure. I don't have that Alaska figure in front of me. I can certainly work to get that. And it is far higher than other professions, absolutely.
Wow, that explains part of our problem. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's why the early experience that a teacher has is so critical. If you can get them off on the right foot, and unfortunately, as you well know, we're an import state, and so many of our teachers are not prepared by the University of Alaska, and the context that they find themselves in is daunting. It is very unfamiliar, and that extra layer of support that ASMP gives helps them over the hump, so to speak, with making the first couple of years successful. But it is indeed the big challenge.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Atwater, and thank you for your input on teacher retention. There are various teacher retention bills making their way through the pipeline right now. We can review the issue and see if any of it's appropriate for Senate Bill 225.
Thank you for your time.
Senator Begich?
I think Gary has a question.
A brief at ease? Senate Education, back in the record. Sorry about that. Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Good to see you. Steve was a superintendent in my district at one time, so known him for a long, long time. But I just wanted to bring up the issue of superintendents and principals. I mean, principals and superintendents are also losing those folks, probably at a just a surprising level when it comes to district superintendents. Do you have some plans or are there plans for including superintendents and principals in mentoring programs, or what do we do for them?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, am I still on the line?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good. I wasn't sure if I could. The Alaska Council of School Administrators has a mentoring program for both principals and superintendents, and so ASMP is strictly for teachers, and so, but there are efforts to support that, and Dr. Parity can, if needed, can come in and fill that out for you. But certainly the principals and the superintendents are critical for our schools and are turning over at an unfortunate rate, but there is some support for them out there through that association.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Atwater.
Thank you. So as we proceed on this, if we do something like a mentoring program, we should include the principals and superintendents too.
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Steve, when I was running a fairly large organization in a previous life, we would bring folks up sometimes from outside, a lot of engineers and procurement specialists and people like that. And it's funny that you say the 3 years, because many of the people we brought up from outside, and this is in the Kenai-Soldotna area, not remote rural Alaska, the longevity was really short. They just weren't prepared. And often a spouse would say, well, we're not staying and we'd like for you to come with us if you want to. But so we really concentrated on hiring local talent of Alaskans that Alaska was their home. They didn't have that adjustment. On a mentoring project and the kinds of bills we're working on, how can we reduce that risk significantly? Where are we lacking in getting young people? And that's a very general question, but I really respect your experience because I assume you went through the same thing as superintendent. But in part of your program, do you have exit interviews, and do you sit with some of these folks to determine what didn't work for them, even maybe as locals, why they're leaving the profession or just are simply unwilling to work in rural Alaska? What kinds of processes do you have to determine what we can do to have a better outcome?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Machicki, thank you for that question. I don't know what ASMP does with regard to exit interviews. I do know that at the district level, they're certainly conducting those exit interviews. Glenda, do you have anything you could add with regard to those ECTs who decide to leave the profession?
Yeah, we just have basic, through the chair, we just have basic information about retention. We do retention postcards. We try to figure out if they stay in-state, out-of-state, where are they going, and most of them are typically exiting out-of-state due to family or just feeling isolated and things like that is what I have noticed in the research.
Follow up, Senator Machicki.
So do you notice a big differential between homegrown teachers and their reasons for exiting versus folks from somewhere else?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. We mainly do the ones that are exiting, and typically those are not the homegrown ones. So we don't do interviews with those that are staying on the ASMP side. But absolutely, I think they stay.
No, through the chair, Senator Machicki, I think if you look at the number of teachers in Alaska, the percent that were prepared by the University of Alaska, which is that homegrown emphasis, right, is about 43%, I think, at last check. It could be higher. I don't know this year's number. I think that those teachers that are prepared out of state come in cold. And so what we need, of course, are more in-state prepared teachers. And this bill, of course, helps to do that. And I think the various efforts, including Educators Rising and that kind of thing, are going to help the pipeline. The bigger issue, and I've mentioned this before, is that, you know, teaching as a profession, it lacks some of the allure that some of the other professions have, right? And I think everything we can do to help improve that or increase that social status or whatever, however you want to frame it, is needed. And the story I've told you and I tell over and over again, that on the Kenai, Senator Machicki, at the end of her graduation, I would mingle with the crowd and talk to the parents. And those parents that had daughters going off to UAA to be nurses were ecstatic and told and did so with a lot of pride. But I never got that about my son or daughter is going to be a teacher. And I think that the social acceptance of going off to be a nurse perhaps exceeds being a teacher. I don't know why. I would argue that teacher is the most important profession in our society. But certainly I think we all need to do more that way. But the local grown teachers are going to stay. We know that UA prepared teachers stay in Alaska in the profession much longer than those prepared out of state. So it's simply a matter of helping to figure out the pathways, such as you've defined in SB 225, to help grease the wheels, so to speak, that we need to do that. The university is working very hard to bring more people into the system, but it's not a pool that's knocking down the doors to go do the or become teachers. And so I think we need to continue as a society to help promote the profession.
Thank you, Dr. Atwater.
All right. Thank you, Senator Mirchicki. Thank you, Dr. Atwater. Thank you, Ms. Findley. And at this point, we're going to move on to our next topic. And next up will be Sandra Meredith from the Department of Education. And Ms. Meredith, if you can hear me, please state your name, affiliation, and your location for the record.
Good morning. My name is Sandra Meredith. I administer teacher certification and education for the Department of Education and Early Development. I'm speaking to you from Juneau today.
All right. Thank you for joining us. First of all, do you have any comments to offer based on the discussion that you've heard previously and today? Feel free to say no. I have some questions for you.
I think everything was well covered.
All right. So one of the questions I had heard was some school districts are going to a four-day week, and there is a complication on that, and it has to do with possibly counting the school year by days instead of hours. Is that correct?
Chair Holland, there is some complications with that, but that is really not my area of expertise. I think we do have other individuals within the department that works on the school calendars and the waivers that we could bring to the committee to speak. But I also think that teacher retirement and benefits really need to speak to this, because it the changes to the calendar may impact issues around the approval of the full year of teaching for the retirement benefit.
All right. Thank you. Duly noted. And the other question I had to do with special education certification flexibility. And can you speak on that a little bit?
Yes. Chair Holland, we have recently made some adjustments to regulations around SPED waivers or alternate paths to SPED certificates that emulates the proof of program enrollment or subject matter expert certification that's currently in statute. I think that change will alleviate some of the issues around bringing in more individuals to do the special ed work in our districts. Also, there has been some issues around the types of programs that individuals are completing out of state, and we've made some changes to how we look at out-of-state certificates that will make it easier for individuals endorsed in out-of-state in other states in special ed to continue using that special ed endorsement moving into their professional licensure. So I think those two regulatory changes will assist in alleviating some of the difficulties with certification around this in this area.
All right, that's the end of my questions. Are there other questions or comments? Senator Hughes.
Yes. I'm just wondering if the department is beginning to think about if we have this year of residency in lieu of this typical student teaching, and the person is working in a classroom, being compensated for that, if there's any consideration of working to reduce in a way that would not bother Senator Stevens, as far as reducing perhaps some of the credit hours they might have to get virtually or on campus because of the difference. I think that a teacher resident, it would be slightly different than student teaching, because I think now with student teaching, the student teacher is there for the required number of hours to meet the credits that they get for student teaching through the university. But a teacher resident, I am imagining, would be treated more like a full-time staff and be part of the culture of that school in that they would attend professional development training, they would be part of staff meetings, they would participate perhaps in extracurricular activities around the school, and perhaps as a coach, they might be involved in selecting curriculum as part of a team of teachers, that kind of thing. So I'm just wondering if there's any consideration that some of that on-the-job type work could be substituted perhaps for a class that they might have to take in order to get their bachelor's degree or teaching certificate.
Through the chair, the nature of the coursework required for those obtaining a bachelor's degree is really not the purview of the department. That is the function of the university system. And so any types of changes or accommodations that would be made in that regard at this point would be up to the university. And we do have Amy Vinlove on the line. If you would like to redirect the question to her, that might be useful.
Senator Hughes? May I clarify? Because what I'm talking about is partnerships, where there would be partnerships, whether it be through DEED or a school district, with higher education institutions to find ways. For instance, I know the Alaska Pacific University gives university credit for certain things that are done in the workplace. And so that's in addition to just the student teaching type of credit, I'm just wondering if there might be other credit that could be awarded to streamline the process and make it more appealing. Whether it be the university, we heard from superintendents last week that some actually are working, unfortunately, with other higher education institutions rather than university. I believe the university was approached to work with them, and they just weren't ready to kick it off. I had the NEA Alaska classified president in my office who said they also approached the university about a way to get paraprofessionals into the pipeline for teachers, and they also are working with another higher education institute rather than the university. But what I'd like to see, I'd like to see partnerships with our university, and in this, because these teacher residents are going to be, it's going to be different than a student teacher who puts in that minimum number of hours and leaves the day. They're going to be part of that school staff team. And I'm just wondering whether there could be some course credit awarded for that, and if the university would be willing to do that, and if DEED and the districts would be willing to work on partnerships to make that happen.
So I'll first go back to Sandra. If you had anything to offer, and then we'll go to Amy from the university.
Through the chair, we most certainly would be willing to partner with anyone to go down this road as potential ways to make the pathways more seamless or for the individuals involved. We would have no part. We would be excited about that, actually. Beyond that, I know that there are structures within the university systems, and I'll let Amy Vinlove speak to that, those around, you know, kind of what their guardrails are in regards to these kind of accommodations.
All right, Ms. Vinlove, if you'd place yourself on the record and offer any input.
Hello. So my name is Amy Vinlove. I'm the director of the School of Education at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I currently serve as the chair of the Alaska College of Education Consortium. And through the chair, in response to your question, Senator Hughes, we currently have existing internship structures that model what is attempting to be done with the apprenticeship bill. So that is currently in place. We have intern teachers who start the year on the first day of the school district that they're doing their internship in. They spend an entire academic year in that classroom, and then they graduate with their licensure after the end of the year. That internship year is a very carefully curated set of integrated experiences between the coursework requirements of the university and the field-based practical experience that they're doing within the internship. So, for example, in a methodology class on learning how to teach elementary math methods, normally a university course would require 45 hours of face-to-face instruction to count as a three-credit class. But during our internship year, our students are actually only going to get 24 hours of face-to-face instruction, and the rest of the time is going to be spent in the classroom actually applying and using that information that's gained in their coursework in a real-world experience. So the entire internship year is integrated between time in the classroom and the critical high-quality teacher preparation that's going on surrounding the science of teaching and learning, and the ability to practice those practices in the classroom under a supervised mentor teacher. So we're super excited and supportive of this bill because it really sort of institutionalizes that very high quality pathway to preparation that is currently offered through the University of Alaska.
All right. Thank you, Director Vinlove. Senator Hughes?
That was helpful. So it does sound like some of the hands-on would reduce the amount of virtual or on-campus classroom time, which I think is important for the residency program.
All right. With no other questions, Senator Michicki.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a different question. I was looking at, so we had the previous presentation where Dr. Atwater talked about the success level of Alaska-grown teachers is significantly higher when we think about retention than folks from somewhere else. That was my experience in the private sector. It's probably across the board in every sector. So the cost in that study was the cost, average cost teacher turnover is $20,431 a year. And that results in about $20 million a year. And that was focused on cost to districts, not necessarily including the state, but we pay the lion's share of education. What could we do? So we have a WAMI program because we know we wouldn't have any homegrown, very few homegrown physicians without WAMI. Do we need to consider something similar with something that entices young people to go into teaching? And I don't believe in loan forgiveness programs generally, but I support WAMI because we know we'd have a shortage without it. Is there a gap on something that could pick up part of the cost for young people that might entice, kick that number up of you're graduating around 200 a year? It obviously isn't filling the gap. Is there something we should consider that might kick that number up significantly with a subsidy of some kind? Remember, when I talk about subsidies, it's because it's reducing the overall cost of the state. It's a fraction of the cost of what we're losing because of retention issues. Can you identify a gap in or some sort of program that might motivate more homegrown Alaskan kids to go to our schools that know what Alaska is about and have chosen Alaska as their home that might increase that number of graduates right here at home?
So through the chair, Senator Michicki, thank you for the question. I think Senate Bill 225 provides support for two areas that are currently identified barriers to developing a diversified homegrown workforce for Alaska schools, which is funding and the need for deep district and university collaborations. And designating teaching as an apprenticeable profession is going to open up access to federal Department of Labor funding sources that, along with a multitude of other existing sources, can help to reduce the cost of becoming a teacher and contribute to a braided funding approach to supporting pre-service teacher expenses, not just for tuition and fees, but also to cover those living costs during that intensive apprenticeship or internship year. The apprenticeship model also requires a very close alignment between coursework and field-based experiences and requires that the University of Alaska teacher preparation programs develop and nurture mutually beneficial partnerships with interested K-12 districts. And I do want to stress that the University of Alaska is eager and willing and enthusiastic to do the work necessary to develop these partnerships, and we certainly look forward to expanding the partnership efforts. So money and incentivizing local partnership building.
And Ms. Meredith?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, I would also point the committee to the teacher education loan program that was discontinued a number of years ago. There's actually statistics around the efficacy of that program and its ability to bring more local teachers into the profession. There is also an innovative program for our healthcare providers where it's not an education loan, but there is monies after the individual actually goes into the profession to support them paying back any loans that they have. Those two other directions have been, but we do have information about within our state that could be informative for the committee moving forward.
Chairman.
Senator Michicki.
I would, if you can please provide whatever information you have to the committee. I mean, I understand the benefits of the bill. I just wonder if it's enough. I look forward to receiving that information. Obviously, if the program was terminated, there was likely a reason for that. Maybe it wasn't effective. Maybe it was. I don't know. But I'd like to learn whatever I can from what we were doing and what worked and what didn't, perhaps.
All right.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Amy, it's good to have you here with us. It's sort of maybe off the subject a little bit, but you are responsible, I think, to some extent for the UAA education program, School of Education there. I know that Fairbanks and Juneau are trying to help out in that situation. Can you tell us this? How is that working? Is that sustainable? Are you comfortable with delivering education service or delivering the opportunity to become teachers in Anchorage as well as Fairbanks?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Stevens. Just to clarify, I am actually the director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Education, there is a University of Alaska Anchorage School of Education also. Following the loss of accreditation for initial licensure programs, they offer only programs that lead to advanced licensure. So that's like a second endorsement or certification on top of your initial licensure. So the work that Fairbanks is doing and that the folks in my unit are doing is in relation to those initial licensure programs, which is the first teaching license. And we are providing those programs on site in Anchorage. So we have faculty down there. We have a full-time advisor down there. We have interns who are placed all across the South Central region. I think that the biggest hurdle has been in communication and in providing very visible evidence of the ability to pursue those pathways. So that's something we've really been approaching at a statewide level with our Teach Alaska website to make it clear that you can enter the University of Alaska's initial licensure programs from anywhere in Alaska. They're going to be site-based. You're going to be able to do that field work wherever you are. I've been in communication with Chancellor Parnell at UAA about the future of their initial licensure programs. But it is a pretty long path to full accreditation for the initial licensure programs within UAA. So we are separately accredited institutions. So we are offering initial licensure under the accreditation that's held by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And the University of Alaska Southeast is also offering initial licensure programs to students who are located in the South Central regions.
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate you stepping into that gap and doing the best we can. Thanks for your comments.
Senator Hughes.
Yes, and thank you for being over the consortium. And I had a very, this was during COVID, so I don't know if it was 1 year or 2 years ago, a very candid conversation. It was by Zoom, so that's why I know it was after COVID started. And it was with superintendents. And it was a very candid conversation that they mentioned that when they hired a new teacher, if the teacher were coming from the UAF program, they were in really good shape and they didn't need a lot of extra help and coaching. However, if they came from the other two campuses, they needed extra help. And I'm just wondering if we're in your position over the consortium, if you're seeing maybe some leveling there where the other campuses are coming up to par with what you're doing at UAF.
I would say that that the opportunity for us to come together collaboratively in this consortium model since July has been really beneficial in terms of the opportunities, the regular monthly or bi-monthly opportunities for sharing across our programs, because we do all have to meet the same accreditation standards, and those accreditation standards are rigorous, as I think I mentioned when I spoke to you before. And any way that we can help each other out in showing the tools and the strategies that we're using, I think it is going to lift the system as a whole. And that's very exciting to me. And I think that is one of the really beneficial parts of the consortium, is that ability for us to grow together and to work collaboratively across the system, if that answers the question.
Yes, thank you. And I would just, one of the things might be good for you as over the consortium is to be checking in with the superintendents and seeing if they're seeing improvement, because it was one superintendent that brought it up, and I think four or five others joined in and confirmed they were seeing the same thing. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Director Vinlove. Thank you, Ms. Meredith. I have two more speakers we're going to try to squeeze in before the end of the meeting today. So at this point, we're going to move on to Anna Velarde from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And I know you're on the phone. You're phoned in. If you can hear me, please state your name, affiliation, and your location for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ann Velarde. I'm the statewide apprenticeship coordinator for the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I'm located in Anchorage.
And I actually don't have any questions. Do you have any comments or clarification on Senate Bill 225 to offer?
I don't. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I'm available to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions for the committee? Seeing none. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Velarde. Next up, I'll go to Kelly Manning. And Kelly Manning, sorry, let me find my notes. Kelly Manning is going to speak on the loan forgiveness programs offered in Alaska. And I see you're joining us with Teams. Thank you for joining us this morning. Would you please state your name, affiliation, your location, and put yourself on the record?
Hi, my name is Kelly Manning. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. I believe Santa Effort is going to speak on the loan forgiveness program, but she was going to try to come in person, but she's double booked to present this morning.
All right. Well, then I'll just ask you, we're getting close to the end of the time today. Did you have any comments or clarification to offer on Senate Bill 225?
Not at this time.
All right. Well, Senator Begich may have a question.
Yeah, just very quickly, Kelly, we're running out of time here, but it was mentioned, you know, data points were mentioned by the, you know, earlier about the former loan forgiveness program. Is that something you could provide us?
Yeah, we'll make note of those questions and follow up with further information.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. With that, I believe we've run through our invited testimony. Are there any other questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for everyone who joined us for the input this morning. We are expecting a committee substitute any day now for Senate Bill 225. My intent is to move the bill next Wednesday. If members have amendments, please work with my staff to submit them by Tuesday, March 29th. And at this point, I'll set a bill 225 aside. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Friday, March 25th at 9 a.m., and we are adjourned at 10:27 a.m.